sign on to that.
Wow, that was got everybody's attention. Good morning. I call this meeting of the Committee on Public Safety, Finance, and Policy to order. We have a quorum, and before we get to the agenda, the normal housekeeping items we have here, everyone should be seated. There's no standing or sitting in the walkways or aisles. Signs aren't permitted, nor are clapping or other disruptions. Thanks to our sergeant's office for all the great work you do to help maintain decorum. And then today, members, we're going to be hearing the various public safety budget requests and recommendations from agencies that fall within the Public Safety Committee's jurisdiction and are contained in House File 2432, the Governor's Public Safety and Judiciary Budget Bill. When it comes time to put together a budget bill, we'll be using House File 2432 as the vehicle, but we will not be taking any action on the bill today. As always, the committee materials have been posted online for the public. And then we'll take questions, members, immediately after each agency presentation. The first order of business is to approve last meeting's minutes. Representative Berg, may I have a motion to approve the minutes for March 26, 2025?
So moved, Madam Chair.
Representative Berg moves approval of the minutes for March 26, 2025. Any discussion? Hearing none, all those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? The motion prevails, and the minutes for March 26, 2025 are approved. Turning it over to Co-Chair Novotny.
I don't have a gift. First presentation we have on the agenda today is from the Office of Ombudsman for Corrections. Ombudsperson Margaret Zadra, will you present virtually today?
Thank you.
Welcome to the committee. Please unmute yourself, state your name and title, and begin your presentation.
Thank you. Margaret Zadra, Ombudsperson for Corrections, and I appreciate you having me here this morning to be able to talk a little bit about our office. Is it sharing?
Yes.
Great.
No.
Sorry about that.
You're good.
I'm sorry, I can't hear it. Is it? It is sharing?
No.
Okay. Try one more button.
There.
Great. Wonderful. Thank you so much. I appreciate it. Our office. Sorry, Margaret Zadra, Ombudsperson for Corrections. Grateful to be here this morning. The statutory mission of our office is to promote the highest attainable standards of competence, efficiency, and justice in the administration of corrections. Our office is completely separate and independent from the Department of Corrections, and we have jurisdiction to review and look at concerns and complaints from incarcerated people, corrections staff, and community members at any DOC facility and any facility licensed by the DOC in Minnesota. We can also address any systemic issues and then work to facilitate resolutions, develop recommendations, and publish reports. We also provide information to help people navigate what is often a confusing and complex system. Our office continues to see our complaint volumes go up over year to year, and due in large part to greater awareness of our mission and greater access to our office. Not only do our complaint numbers keep going up, but also the types of complaints we receive, the complexity of those, and the investigations that we do related to those have also greatly increased. In order to effectively manage this, we really prioritize cases that involve health, safety, and well-being issues. Part of those effective creative strategies to work on that effectiveness is increasing face time at facilities. So we do open office hours at most facilities. And then whenever possible, we utilize informal recommendations to inform policy changes. One of the other things we do, we're a small team. Everybody wears lots and lots of hats. And so we focus on ensuring that our team has many different areas of background and expertise and utilize that experience well. And then we've looked at our processes to ensure that we're being as effective as we can be and work collaboratively across those different expertise areas. Our current budget is $1.1 million completely from the general fund, and that supports 8 full-time staff. We like to highlight the minimal cost for such a significant resource for the work we do across the state. When we look at the overall public safety and judiciary budget, that's only about 5% of the general fund budget. Our budget is about 0.6% of that public safety and judiciary budget. This coming fiscal year, the request is for 1.118, and that would support 7 full-time staff. Staffing really is the vast majority of our budget. It's people going out doing the work, investigating, talking to other people, and then the rest of our budget really is those mandated expenses, our lease, our IT costs, printing, travel to facilities across the state. The impact that the ongoing investments brings is that we are continuing to ensure neutral and independent review of facilities, deliver unbiased investigations, decrease legal actions against those agencies and facilities, promote better processes overall, and provide for individual and systemic resolutions. And that all of that work really does contribute to safer and healthier facilities for incarcerated people, corrections staff, and communities. That is all I have, but happy to stand for any questions.
Members, questions for the ombudsperson? Representative Feist.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Is the ombudsperson still there, or did we lose connection?
Oh. I'm still here.
Okay, we can't see you, but as long as you can hear me, that's good. I was just curious. I know this is a budget presentation, and I know that your role is to receive complaints, so you might not have this information, but I was just curious, over your time in this role, is there anything that we're doing right? Like, I know that we in our budget have tried to, you know, strategically direct funding to make sure that, you know, people are, you know, in a safe environment, and, you know, we're just, you know, as the legislature, we're always trying to strategically fund corrections. And so are there any trends that you see that are positive, like certain types of complaints that you used to receive that you're receiving less of?
Oh, absolutely. So we absolutely, thank you, sorry.
Go ahead.
Yes, thank you, Chair, Member Feist. Yeah, we absolutely see a decrease in areas that we're spending a lot of time on, or if the facilities are spending a lot of time on. Absolutely. You know, several years ago, we had a really significant report related to the grievance process and what that and some challenges there. And I think there was 9 recommendations that we made, and all of them were accepted. They've been continuing to be implemented over the years, and we have seen a significant decrease. I don't have the number exactly in front of me, but significant decrease about complaints about the process itself, right? And I think that's an across the board thing, that both work that we are doing and facilities are doing around certain areas, we do absolutely see decrease from people around those areas. We're seeing a lot of really creative ideas about how, you know, some substance use treatment is being implemented in facilities. And I think that across the board, when we're talking to facilities, we aren't just talking about what isn't going well. We also are talking about what is going well. And a lot of times then we're able to help promote those better practices as well. Absolutely.
Representative Feist?
Yeah, thank you.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The question I have, in your presentation, you make reference to increased leave as one of the reasons for the size of the budget request. Do you have some sense of what percentage of the increase in budget is a result of the increases in leave that are anticipated due to recent law changes?
Ombudsperson Zadra.
Chair, Representative, I'm not sure what you're referring to about increases in leave. Can you restate the question?
Representative Hudson.
Yeah, it was in the presentation. Hold on here. Let me look at it. There we go. So the pages aren't numbered, but the page that talks about 7 FTEs due to increasing IT infrastructure and leave increases.
Thank you. Sorry. Chair, Representative. I think the maybe leave increases isn't the right term there. It probably should be increases in, you know, expected any kind of step increases. Leave increases probably wasn't the accurate word there. We're covering right around being able to support that and with any anticipated just overall inflation cost increases, that's where that decrease comes in.
Representative Hudson. I'm good. Thank you. Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ombudsperson Zadra, are you guys expecting salary increases for those FTEs?
Ombudsperson Zadra.
Chair, Representative, no salary increases beyond what would be a typical step increase that's part of their contract.
Representative Engen.
I'm sorry, I'm not quite understanding. Is that a yes or a no?
No.
Representative Engen.
I'll take that as a no.
Are there anyone else wants to ask a question of the testifier? Thank you, members, and Ombudsperson Zadra.
All right. The next presentation we have on the agenda today is from the Clemency Review Commission. We have Executive Director Carly Stark here with us today. Welcome back to the committee, Director Stark, and please go ahead and state your name before you begin your presentation. All right, I'm just going to pull up the presentation quickly. All right, is the presentation up? All right. Thank you, Chair, members of the committee. My name is Carly Stark, and I'm the Executive Director of the Clemency Review Commission. The Clemency Review Commission is a new agency as of July 1st, 2024. The clemency work that was previously done was housed within the DOC, which is why we are now an independent agency. Since I haven't been in front of this committee before, I'll give a brief overview of what our agency does. We screen all clemency applications for eligibility, recommend to the Board of Pardons whether to grant or deny those applications, whether they should hold hearings. We provide victim services, assistance to applicants, and we carry out the administrative functions of the Board of Pardons. So clemency, generally when people think of that, it's pardons and commutations. Pardons are for people who have finished their criminal sentence, shown a period of rehabilitation. The Board of Pardons has the authority to set aside a conviction, which will remove some collateral consequences of that conviction, generally related to employment, housing, and firearms rights. Commutations are for people who are still under sentence, so that could mean that they are either incarcerated or under some kind of supervision, and the Board of Pardons has the authority to reduce that sentence from what the court originally provided. The Board of Pardons is made up of the governor, the Attorney General, and the Chief Justice. Minnesota is unique in that respect. Many states vest authority for clemency solely within the executive branch, so the governor. We have a unique situation in our Constitution that requires a majority of the three-member board for clemency. The Clemency Review Commission is basically an advisory commission that provides recommendations to the board, and it's three members of the commission appointed by each of the Board of Pardons members. And in your packet, there's the names of each of those commission members. So the next page is an overview of the amount of applications we've received. You can see that this year, since becoming an independent agency, we've had a 118% increase in pardon applications, so just over twice as many applications. We've had a slight decrease in commutations, but it's
9 applications, so not a significant decrease. As far as applications, we have 130 pardons that are currently pending, and the remaining hearing spots for the rest of the year are 72. So we do have more applications than we have time to hear within this year. However, we are going to be promulgating rules to create an expedited process related to nonviolent offenses that should help with those numbers. As you can see, in 2024, the amount of hearings that we were able to hold was significantly higher, and that's due to the additional capacity created by the agency. So some of the things we've done this year was we created an agency. We've held 5 commission meetings, 8 committee meetings. We have a new website with a lot of information about the process. We now have a dedicated victim services provider that provides advocacy for victims specifically related to the clemency review process. We also have a grant program for outreach and application assistance. The next slide just goes through some of those victim services we provide. So I'll let you review those in your packets. So our current budget is $786,000 for operating funds and $200,000 for outreach and application assistance grants. That supports 5 FTEs, a dedicated victim services provider, and it's 100% from the general fund. The request for the next biennium is $995,000 for fiscal year 26 and $1.005 million for fiscal year 27. That will allow us to maintain our staff, which will means we can continue to process applications at the rate we are currently processing them. And importantly, we can maintain our victim services contract because this process is really difficult for applicants, but it's also very difficult for victims, and so it's very important that we have those services available. That is my presentation, so I'm open for questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Director Stark. Member discussion or questions? Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Referencing page 4 on your presentation, I'm hoping for some clarity on what it is that I'm seeing here. So if I'm understanding correctly based on how you described it, there's been 118% increase in applications, but a slight decrease in commutations. That seems odd to me. Is it that there's more people applying than qualify for commutation once they go through the hearing process? What's the background there?
Director Stark.
Yes, thank you, Chair, Representative. So it's just that it's the difference between pardons and commutations. So pardons is it's people in the community and more people are learning about this process. And for commutations, I don't actually know how to explain that decrease. I think those numbers have stayed relatively steady in just how many applications we receive. So as I said, it's about 9 applications less from people within facilities.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you. So these numbers are the numbers of applications.
Correct.
Director Stark.
Got it. Thank you.
Other member questions? All right. Not seeing anything else. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Next presentation we have on the agenda today is from the Board of Private Detective and Protective Agent Services. We have Director Greg Cook here with us today. Welcome to the committee, Director Cook. State your name and title and begin your presentation.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee members. My name is Greg Cook, and I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Board of Private Detectives and Protective Agents. I provided a handout which gives some detail to our agency. I understand that my time is limited, so I'm only going to highlight a few points from that handout. Our agency regulates 14,600 private investigators and protective agents here in Minnesota. We work at the direction of our board, which consists of 5 members. By regulating the industry, we perform the following core tasks: license application processing, license renewal processing, statute violation and complaint investigations, unlicensed activity investigations, investigative audits, penalty administration, training class and instructor certification, and data request processing. In regards to our budget, I'm not here asking for any money. Rather, I am here to report to you of the success from the last biennium's budget increase, as it was this committee that supported that initiative. A little bit of history. I was the executive director of this agency from 2012 to 2020. I then retired. Recently, I was asked by the BCA DPS to come back to this position, which I did this last November. To give you some perspective of our agent's budget history, when I was here in 2012, the total annual budget was $120,000. By the time I left in 2020, the annual budget was $278,000. At that time, I had an administrative assistant, an investigative analyst, and a part-time student worker. A wonderful thing happened when I retired. Legislature increased this agency's budget up to $688,000 annually. This provided funds for a much-needed record and licensing management system, along with a staffing increase. Happy to report, we are at the tail end of the DPS hiring process, and we will be reaching more adequate staffing levels. This will bring the agency staff to a total of 4.5 FTEs and myself. One of the most important benefits of the budget increase is the ability to implement the electronic record licensing management system. For 50 years, this agency handled every document as hard copy paper. With the new record management system, most of our processes will be done electronically. License holders and trainers will be able to submit and receive data for applications, renewals, officer changes, submit training, and have access to needed information. The public and law enforcement will be able to access information on our license holders and trainers in terms of verifying their credentials. Our staff will be able to generate reports quickly and accurately. Our staff's labor hours are going to be reduced drastically, allowing us to work on other important matters. The agency also had a retention policy that was set at permanent. This meant that we kept every piece of paper since 1974. I changed that to a 7-year retention schedule prior to me leaving last time, but we were still left with an enormous amount of paper documents. We took that documentation, had it scanned, indexed, and we'll be merging it with the record management system. This will greatly improve our ability to manage a large amount of data. Please note that the current biennium budget report you have for this agency was written before I came back and I was unable to modify it. I want to note that the agency's strategies have changed. My goal in coming back to this position is to get the agency up to full staff. That is nearly complete. Implement the record management system. This is in process with a projected completion date in June. Digitize our data. That is done. Develop an actual policy and procedure manual. That is in process. The biggest benefit with having this new budget is that it actually gives our agency wiggle room to work on the statutes. Our statutes were originally written in 1974 and have not had any major revisions since. We need to bring our statutes into the current century. There are technical aspects, including things like drones and GPS tracking units, that have to be addressed. There are training aspects that have to address the current environment. There are definitions that need more clarity. My goal going forward is to work towards rewriting the entire set of statutes that deal with this industry here in Minnesota. That is my brief presentation. I am more than happy to take any questions.
Any questions for Director Cook? Thank you, Director Cook. Are there any members? And we'll turn it back over to Chair Moore.
Thank you. Thank you for your time.
All right, the next presentation we have is from the Sentencing Guidelines Commission. We have Executive Director Nate Wrights here with us today. Welcome back to the committee, and please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Nate Wrights. I'm the Executive Director of the Minnesota Sentencing Guidelines Commission. I'm here today to talk about, in the few minutes that we have, to talk about the agency's budget request. One of the things I won't be presenting to you today are the data concerning sentencing practices in Minnesota. We're certainly happy to do that. We've done that in the past with the legislature, and you all should have received the annual report to the legislature in January, which does talk about some of those data practices, talks about how, for example, how many people are going to prison, whether the sentencing guidelines recommendations are being followed or departed from and how frequently that happens. A lot of interesting information if you're interested in sort of the factors that feed into ultimately the correctional population in Minnesota. But that's not what I'm here to talk about today. I'm here to talk about the agency's budget request. So two sort of illustrations about the agency's budget historically. The pie chart on the left is old data, but it does reflect historically what the trends have been in our agency, which is the vast majority of it has been compensation for our six and now seven full-time employees. The 92% in the previous biennium. As we'll talk about in a minute, gives us little wiggle room as far as exposure to, for example, budget cuts and that sort of thing. 8% operating expenses and so forth. And you can see on the right side of this is a bar chart showing the last 10 years of agency funding by biennium. And you'll notice there was a pretty steady amount of funding until the current biennium, where there was a significant increase that the legislature funded 2 years ago. Part of that was ongoing, that's reflected in the blue, and part of that was one time, and that's reflected in the green. So what was that increase for in FY24-25? As I said, a significant amount of that was one-time funding for one-time projects, and there were two major projects that we've undertaken during this biennium. One is a comprehensive review of the sentencing guidelines, phase one. So the sentencing guidelines were established pretty much in 1979, took effect in 1980, and have been reviewed pretty much nonstop ever since, but never on a holistic, comprehensive basis. So there's never been sort of a look, step back and see, are the guidelines actually accomplishing what they're supposed to be accomplishing and what are they supposed to be accomplishing? So that's what the agency is currently undergoing right now. We've had a lot of interesting stakeholder feedback that's been funded by this appropriation. We've had assistance from an elite team of researchers at the University of Minnesota. There's been a lot of effort poured into phase one. Unfortunately, this budget does not fund phase two, as we'll talk about later. Chair Mitchell, who's also here because she's an assistant commissioner of corrections in her day job, has a plan to complete the comprehensive review with existing resources. That is currently ongoing during this biennium. The second one-time project was establishing data integrations with court information systems, essentially modernizing how we get information from one of our chief sources of information, which is the courts. We're going to be integrating with them instead of the analogy I use is instead of getting our bank statement at the end of every month, we're going to have an app where we can actually see real time what the balance is and that sort of thing. So not only modernizing our integration systems, but also modernizing our database to take that new data, and that's currently in development. And we appreciate the funding for those one-time projects. We also have ongoing expenses that were funded in FY24-25, all very worthwhile. One was adding a new FTE. We've had a very, very, very stable complement of six FTEs for really a very, very long time. This is adding a new FTE. The four of the six FTEs are researchers. We have a mission as the Clearinghouse and Information Center for Sentencing Practices Data in the state, and we also, as we'll talk about in the next slide, do monitor and review all sentencing worksheets, tens of thousands of worksheets every year. But those researchers did not have a research-trained supervisor. They just had me. Sorry, I just went to law school, so didn't have that expertise. Now we have a research supervisor who is developing efficiencies within the research staff and improving the research products that we're putting out. So we're really excited to see that getting going. The other is a little more boring, that we had to hire the small agency resource team. It's really been overdue for a long time. I'm embarrassed to tell you, when the OLA audit came out that said, hey, you guys are getting free HR and finance services from the DOC, that really ought to be paid for or somehow worked out. So we're finally paying for that. And finally, ongoing tech support for Mensa's integration. So that's regarding that project that we talked about, the Mensa's integrations project. The governor's budget request is a 2.8% operating adjustment. This is simply to fund ongoing services. Again, as I said, we review approximately 20,000 felony sentencing worksheets for accuracy each year, answer hundreds of practitioner phone calls. I love to say that when you call our agency, you actually get a human who can tell you something about how the sentencing guidelines work. We also do individual data requests. We report on those for individuals hundreds of times a year. Collect, analyze, and report data on statewide sentencing practices and conduct research to support the commission's ongoing work. So this small staff, seven people, efficiently facilitates the functioning of Minnesota's statewide felony sentencing structure. And the governor's requesting $20,000 in FY 2026 and $40,000 in following years to mitigate impacts to current levels of service and information to the public. As I said, we're very price sensitive. If there are price increases, we don't really have ways to accommodate that. We don't have a slush fund, as I like to say. We are expecting significant price increases for Minute that we know of. We don't necessarily know of all our personnel compensation increases at this time, but we are grateful for the governor's request to at least fund a 2.8% increase for some of that. And as I reported earlier, phase two of the sentencing guidelines comprehensive review is not funded in this package, obviously due to the tight fiscal constraints that we're under this year. Madam Chair, if there are any questions.
Thank you, Director Wrights. Member discussion. Oh, I thought you were pointing. Chair Novotny.
Hey, Director Rice, thank you for being here. A couple questions. You make reference in your flyer that you're modernizing the data systems and the current status is in development. Without going way too deep into the weeds, could you just walk me through? You described yourself as a clearinghouse. Information comes from the courts, and then you disseminate that information out. How does that information get to you or your organization? How is it maintained? And you talked about the researchers. So people make requests saying what's going on or what are the trends? How do you handle those? How do you get the information in? It's collected by you. How is it maintained in that way? And then how is it disseminated?
Direct rights.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. So great question. So we actually don't. The courts are not our only source of information. We also have, we're housed in the Department of Corrections statewide supervision portal. We have an electronic worksheet system that is run by Department of Corrections, but essentially we're the business owners of that. And every probation officer in the state who prepares felony sentencing worksheets has access to that electronic worksheet system. So all worksheets, all sentencing worksheets, and the sentencing worksheet is the document that the judge has in front of him or her on the bench when sentencing a defendant. And so that explains what the defendant's criminal history score is, what the severity of the current offense is, what the guidelines presume the offense should be to give the judge a starting point for sentencing. That's done outside of the Mensa's, outside of the court information system. So we get data from Department of Corrections and from the electronic worksheet system, and essentially we know what the presumptive sentence is. So that's essentially a separate data structure, and then we find out what the sentence was. We find out what actually happened in the case from Mensa's, from the courts. So we have to put those two together. We have to match them up and figure out, was there a departure from the sentencing guidelines? Then we go look for departure reports from the judges. Judges are required to file a departure report if they depart from the sentencing guidelines. It explains the substantial and compelling reasons why they had to depart. And we have to marry those up. If we don't find a departure report, we have to request departure reports from judges. So there's a lot involved. It's not just getting the data from courts and then regurgitating it out. A lot of it is, we're the ones who basically make the determination from a data point of view whether or not there was a sentencing departure and what kind of departure it was. Point number one. And with respect to your second question about data requests, we get data requests from members of the media, members of the public, members of the legislature, academics. We get a wide variety of data requests asking about sentencing practices data. One of the advantages of being the oldest sentencing guidelines state in the nation is we have one of the best records of sentencing practices data going back to the early 1980s. So we have renowned, nationally, internationally renowned high quality sentencing practices data, which you do not find in every jurisdiction. So we get a lot of requests for that data looking for sentencing practices.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So the court reports that come to you, are those electronically also?
Director Reitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mr. Chair, yes, they are electronically, but it's not in an integration system. So as I said, it's like the end of the month bank statement. And the problem with that, sometimes sentences change. Sometimes the court corrects a sentence and we don't always know about that. We just get a static monthly report on what the sentences were that month. So we're hoping will reduce errors in our misunderstanding of what the sentence was, because we didn't catch that there was a change and that sort of thing. So this will be a dynamic data system rather than a static, really old school data system.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. So my question, I'll be more specific about it. Yeah. Is it coming into you, and I'm dating myself, is it coming into you like in a fax form, or is it a scan form, or is it,
no,
as you described, the electronic worksheet, is it on a set form that is transferred to you so that you get all the information that's able to be inputted, or do you get it in a sheet electronically as a scan that you then have to translate and put in?
Director Reitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair, Mr. Chair. And thank you for that question. Perhaps I was overstating the case by saying it's like a bank statement. It is electronically received. So we do receive it as a database, but it's a static data dump that we get every month rather than a dynamic integrations, which is really the more modern way. And I should say, by the way, we are kind of coming up on the tail end. The Mensis has dynamic integrations with I'm not a Mensis spokesperson, but with scores of state users throughout the state. So it's really high time we caught up and had dynamic integrations ourselves.
And I have a question for you as well. I know when we get fiscal notes here at the legislature, there's often very detailed information from the Guidelines Commission, and we appreciate that detailed information. I'm just curious about either how much time or how much staff time you spend on those fiscal notes every session.
Well, you can ask my boss. I told her I'm working for LBO now. It's taking a lot of time. This has been a very interesting session as far as the, it seems to be fairly compressed too. Like in the last 2 weeks, we've gotten a lot of fiscal note requests from you and from the other body. And it certainly kept us busy. We're trying to be helpful. And basically our primary role in fiscal note processing is that we attempt to estimate how many prison beds a particular bill will cost or save, if any. And then we pass that along to the Department of Corrections, and they put a dollar value on those prison beds saved or costing. And then that's the fiscal note. But we recognize that it's a significant undertaking. Each bed is represents a significant amount of the government's fisc, and we want to make sure that we're doing as good a job as possible so that we give you as accurate information as possible, keeping in mind we don't have a crystal ball.
All right, thank you. Well, we certainly appreciate that work. Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question, given the fact that you've been undergoing this comprehensive review of the guidelines, how does your work interact with legislative intent, both past and present? So, for instance, part of the reason why you're having to look at fiscal notes is because we're contemplating potentially increasing penalties for this, that, or the other thing. If those bills become law and there's an increase in penalties, how does that impact the work of the Sentencing Guidelines Commission? How does our intention fit into your process?
Director Reitz.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, the legislature, we look at, for example, statutory maximums. That's one of the ways that the legislature communicates its intent. If there's, for example, that there was a bill, I can't remember which bill it was, but that would increase penalties for theft if the theft was from the government. And, you know, it increased it by 20%, and that we assume that the, in our fiscal note for that, that the legislature, that the commission would probably interpret that as a signal from the legislature that it wants theft from the government to be a little more serious and maybe ranked one step higher on the severity level scale than regular theft of the same amount of money. So that's one way that the legislature can do that is through its legislative intent. And of course, the legislature is also given its intent in the commission's charter statute, where it talks about exactly what sorts of things the commission needs to consider when it decides how to rank particular offenses or how to what presumptive sentences to establish, the primary consideration being public safety.
Anything further?
Thank you.
All right, not seeing any other questions. Thank you so much.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Next presentation we have on the agenda today is from the Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training, also known as the POST Board. We have Executive Director Eric Misselt here with us today. Welcome to the committee, Director Misselt. Please state your name, title, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Thank you for having me today. My name is Eric Misselt. I'm the Executive Director for the Minnesota Board of Peace Officer Standards and Training. I'm going to try and keep this relatively brief because there's not a whole lot we're looking for in the budget this year. I think most of you are familiar with the POST Board. I'll just give a quick short rundown of who we are and what we do. The board is a licensing and regulatory agency within the executive branch. We oversee right now approximately 10,500 peace officer licenses across the state. We operate as a licensing board just like nursing or the board of lawyers, et cetera. We cover everything from pre-service training to in-service training to licensing of new officers and then, of course, regulation regarding conduct. With regard to the budget, we have just two items. One of those is the operating adjustment, which other agencies have already spoken to you about, recommended by the governor, and we appreciate that. And that's simply to appropriate enough money for ongoing increased expenses that we foresee on the horizon. And then the other budget item is the Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund. And in that, there is a request for $2 million in fiscal 26, and there are no tails or anything after 26. That is something that has been funded since 2018 at different levels, and so that's what is being requested this year based on the governor's recommendations. Thank you.
Members, questions for Director Misselt? Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So can you explain why the governor didn't have any money listed for the Philando Castile Memorial Training Fund in his budget proposal? Any insight into that?
Director Misselt.
Chair Novotny and member, yes. I can't explain. We're not part of those conversations necessarily. The governor makes their recommendations, and I'm sure they have their reasons. We recognize the need for training funds ever since 2018, and from the board standpoint, we will administer whatever funds are appropriated by the governor and the legislature.
Representative Ng.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So we see a $6 million cut in 2027, so the entirety of the fund being eliminated. Can you talk to me about what the ramifications of that would be?
So there are, the difference will be that agencies obviously will not have that money to reimburse. What I can tell you is that there is an ongoing appropriation under the POST Board for around $2.9 million. That has been in place for many years, even prior to me coming to POST, and that is still in our budget. The $6 million was appropriated originally in 2018 with the additional mandatory training requirements. And I can tell you that the agencies out there spend way more than what is appropriate. So this is a partial reimbursement, and in this case, yes, that reimbursement will be less than it has been the last, since 2018.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you for that. It just seems like a little bit of a problem for us to mandate this training and yet not reimburse for it. If we want to make reforms, if we want to increase the effectiveness and the scope of which our police are conducting their business on a day-to-day account, then let's fund that. Thank you.
Representative Witte, or Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Director Missel, in the next year to 5 years, what's the retirement look for law enforcement? We always talk about recruitment and retention, and I'm just trying to get a sense. We get ideas or heard, but what are you seeing?
Director Missel.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Representative Witte, I guess that's probably out of my pay grade. I'm not sure what the demographics are. I know generally the retirement across all industries and areas is a pending and looming issue for sure. That's probably, although I think if I said anything else, I'd be speaking out of my particular knowledge base.
Vice Chair Witte.
No, thank you.
Representative Duran.
Thank you for being here. Has the FTEs increased in the last 5 years, and can you explain to me why?
Director Miss.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Yes, the FTEs were increased last budget session, so two sessions ago. A lot of that revolved around additional regulation that was passed both through rule and legislation. The rulemaking in particular had a big impact on it. It expanded the scope of areas that fall within the board's jurisdiction. So it opened up an increase in the number of complaints that can be filed. And so we needed additional staff to manage that.
Representative Brand.
Can you tell me how many staff you added?
Thank you, Chair, members. If I recall correctly, it was authorized for 4 additional staff. We are currently at 15, and we were at 11 or 12 at the time.
Representative Duran. Anyone else for Director Missel? Thank you, members, and Director Missel.
Thank you.
Next up, we have the Department of Public Safety, and I believe we have 4, we have the commissioner, the state fire marshal, we've got the interim director for OJP and the superintendent here. So why don't you all come up as you are doing, and then you can, whatever order you're gonna present is fine with us as long as you introduce yourself for the record first so that we know who's speaking. Welcome back.
We call that a dramatic entrance. Good morning, everybody. I am Commissioner Jacobson. You would like us to introduce each person before we start? Was that the direction?
Just when you're ready, whoever's speaking before they speak. They
got
can.
It.
Sorry. All right.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, again, my name is Bob Jacobson, and I'm the Commissioner of the Department of Public Safety. Thank you for having DPS here today to discuss Governor Walz and Lieutenant Governor Flanagan's 2025 budget for our public safety divisions. So I'll present the agency-wide proposal, and then each division director will come up and present their items in more detail. We'll all be available for questions at the end. As you know, DPS has divisions that fall within the jurisdiction of the Judiciary and Public Safety Committee and the Transportation Committee, so just a quick review. Public safety divisions include alcohol and gambling enforcement, state fire marshal office of justice programs, emergency communication networks, homeland security, Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and you can see what falls into the transportation side, which we'll not be talking about today. Just as a point of information, we, as an agency, we have put forward about a $9 million in budget reductions for the next biennium for the transportation side of the budget. What I'll talk about today includes, number one, an operating adjustment. As has been mentioned by others here, we continue to need to be able to do our work. We have over 2,200 employees statewide, and certainly, you know, our employees are committed to delivering high-quality care and services to all Minnesotans. We're seeing an increase that will help us adjust and react to increases in pay, increases in benefits, all those other things that impact our services, all the while trying to maintain as best we can our current levels of service. We're also asking for grant administration authority for all the grants that we administer and oversee within the Department of Public Safety. There are several of them. We are committed to ensuring that those grant dollars are maximized and have the greatest impact. Certainly a critical part of, as we all know, of administering those grants is to make sure that we have critical oversight of those functions, to make sure that we are combating and eliminating fraud, waste, and abuse of public funds. So all those actions include soliciting, reviewing, and selecting applicants, pre-risk award assessments, again, ensuring expenses are allowable and according to the grant terms and all those other duties that go along with grant administration. This proposal would protect those grant fund investments and allow us to use up to 5% of grant funds for non-competitive grants and 10% of grant funds for competitive grants to make sure that we're able to ensure stable and adequate funding. I'd also like to mention that we will recommending a one-time transfer to MnDOT for capital improvements for the armor radio system, the backbone that supports armor radio system around the state of Minnesota. MnDOT, as you know, supports the infrastructure piece of the armor radio system, and we're asking for authority to transfer $14 million to MnDOT, again, to make sure that we ensure that we have a backbone for the armor radio system around the state of Minnesota that continues to operate to support our public safety members and the community around the state of Minnesota. With that, I'll turn it over to our state fire marshal.
Good morning. I'm Dan Cryer, and I'm the state fire marshal. And yeah, I'm happy to talk about what is included in the governor's budget recommendations for our division. So we have our mission. We make sure everything we're doing is grounded in fulfilling our mission and working toward our mission on having a fire-safe environment in Minnesota and providing that leadership. And a number of items included in the recommendations may seem to not fall directly into supporting fire-safe, but in the fire service, a number of items that are public safety-related expand into other areas such as hazardous materials and advanced capabilities for search and rescue. So the recommendations that are included in the governor's budget recommendations here are a move and increase to the appropriations for urban search and rescue teams and the Minnesota Air Rescue Teams. So those are three different distinct teams. We have two urban search and rescue teams in Minnesota, Task Force 1 and Task Force 2. And they are comprised of fire departments who come together with a joint powers agreement and give advanced training for urban search and rescue. Things like structural collapse, a high angle rescue or low angle rescue. So if somebody's enjoying the cliffs, the mines, all the great geography we have in Minnesota, if something goes wrong, we have people with advanced level training and equipment to be able to go assist them when that's needed. This recommendation improves our internal controls on reimbursements. This was a finding in a recent audit report that highlighted management of these teams is performed by the State Fire Marshal Division. Previously, these appropriations in this current biennium are given to the Minnesota Board of Firefighter Training. And so to have better oversight for internal controls, this appropriation addresses that finding. And then the increase that's requested is to continue to support the advanced equipment and training that these individual, these fire departments and these firefighters and rescuers go through. It also increases some additional capabilities, and I want to highlight specifically for the Minnesota Air Rescue Team. So our state patrol has a new helicopter with a greater distance it can travel before it has to fuel. It can has better hoist capabilities, and so notable incidents that may happen up in the boundary waters, we can now, with that helicopter, we can provide rescue services for anybody that's up there, and that comes with this increased appropriation is more training to be able to utilize the new equipment that came with the new helicopter. And then our hazardous materials response teams, they are also local fire departments. We have 11 of them throughout the state, and they are the specialists that respond when there is a major hazardous materials incident. Could be a rail incident, it could be a pipeline incident, could be anything, an unknown chemical, a white powder letter, so to speak. It's these teams have advanced and specialized field detection equipment. They have specialized suits, and so this increase goes to replace some outdated equipment for them and to continue to support their mission for the evolving risks in Minnesota, specifically around hazmat. And then our last recommendation is proposing an increase to the public charter school inspection fees. So in statute, charter schools are separated from traditional public schools. I recognize that a charter school is a public school. So if I say charter school, I'm not creating a line there. I'm just referencing what we have in our statute. So today, public schools, for their fire inspections, they are charged on a per square footage fee. And this proposal aims to have charter schools also have a per square footage fee. So the larger the school, the longer it takes to inspect, the greater the cost it is to the inspecting agency, which in this case would be the state fire marshal. Right now it's a flat $100 fee, no matter the size of the public charter school. And then this also has an impact to about 12 cities who still have jurisdiction and delegation from us to do fire inspection, the required fire inspections for public schools and public charter schools. So I have two examples here of some schools that public charter schools that would be included here and are inspected on a triannual basis. So we have one up in Tower, Vermilion Country School, approximately 13,000 square feet. And then we have Athos Leadership Academy, and this one I'm familiar with because I was a fire marshal in Brooklyn Park before accepting this role. And that is 100,000 square feet. So a difference 8 times in size. And yet today, $100 is the inspection fee, but you can see it would, as you can imagine, it takes a longer amount of time to walk and inspect a building that's 100,000 square feet versus one that's 13,000 square feet. So looking for parity between the public schools and the public charter schools, and then to be able to have that equitable fee between the two. Now I'll have hand it over to our interim director for OJP.
Madam Chair, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Kim Babine, and I'm the Interim Executive Director for the Office of Justice Programs. The Office of Justice Programs provides leadership to and resources to reduce crime, improve the functioning of the criminal justice system, and to assist crime victims. We do this by administering grants, providing training and technical assistance, providing research and data, and we work to protect crime victim rights and provide reimbursement benefits to victims of violent crime. Thanks. The governor has two proposals for the budget this year for the Office of Justice Programs. The first is for crime victim services grants. A network of over 150 community-based organizations, tribal governments, and local governments provide crime victim services, direct services to victims of crime throughout the state. This funding provides services to victims of sexual assault, domestic abuse, child abuse, and other crimes such as homicide, gun violence, assault, and theft. They're an integral part of public safety. Research shows that when victims receive these services, they're more likely to seek health care and report crime to law enforcement. which strengthens the ability of communities and first responders to address and prevent violent crimes. The services to crime victims seek to address the needs of individuals who are fleeing violence in the home, those seeking services and support after a violent incident. Specifically, the funding provides support to survivors through safety planning, crisis intervention, advocacy, assistance applying for protective orders, safe housing, transportation, accessing financial assistance, court-related support, accompaniment to hearings and appointments, in addition to support groups and healing services. And without crime victim services, victims are left to deal with the consequences of their victimization alone, resulting in less safety and support in our communities. The second proposal from the governor is for the Intensive Comprehensive Peace Officer and Training Grant Program. The Intensive Comprehensive Peace Officer Training Program is a legislatively created grant program for Minnesota law enforcement agencies to help recruit new peace officers. As was just mentioned a few minutes ago, vacancies at law enforcement agencies are high across the state, and this is a recruitment tool that meets that need and potentially mitigate the growing challenge there. The way it works is law enforcement agencies are awarded grant funds, and then they're able to sponsor candidates with 2 or 4 year degrees who are interested in making a career transition. They can then be hired from within their own communities and will obtain the required education to become a peace officer in less than 8 months, when usually that can take a couple of years. Agencies benefit from hiring transition candidates with pre-existing or professional experience in other settings. And it offers non-traditional or career transition candidates to serve their communities in a new way. And I'll pass it over to Superintendent Evans.
Thank you, Chair Moeller and Chair Novotny and members of the committee. My name is Drew Evans. I'm superintendent of the Minnesota Bureau of Criminal Apprehension. Our mission is to prevent, investigate, and solve crimes in collaboration with our criminal justice partners. And so we are your state's criminal investigative agency, comprised of our investigations division, which does criminal investigations supporting our partners across Minnesota, our forensic science services, which is the state's crime laboratory, doing a variety of different forensic analysis, and then MINJIS, Minnesota Justice Information Services, which is all of the database and fingerprints and criminal history systems for the state. And then we have a small but busy training section providing training for Minnesota law enforcement. We train approximately 6,000 to 9,000 law enforcement students. A couple of items to note for this committee that are in the governor's revised budget recommendations. One of the items that we've been working on is a combination of the BCA Financial Crimes section and the Commerce Fraud Bureau to combine into one large and focused unit that focuses on financial crimes, traditional financial crimes, insurance fraud, wage theft and misclassification crimes, and also fraud in government programs. I want to be clear, as you contemplate a number of different issues, this unit will focus on the criminal investigation once potential criminal fraud and then those other areas are identified, and they will be handled much like any other case that is referred to us in there. Part of this ensures a coordinated approach and focused resources. This unit combined together between the BCA and Commerce Fraud results in a unit of approximately 43 or so FTEs between sworn law enforcement investigators and then criminal intelligence analysts and support working on that, making that, you know, a mid to larger size police agency singularly focused on financial crimes and fraud across the state of Minnesota. This, in the budget, supplemental budget, codifies a number of technical changes to make that completely effective. But to be clear, through the state's administrative authority, that reorganization has occurred. It's been going well. The teams are working very well together today, and they're intaking cases as the new unit. As part of that, there's a small budget recommendation to fill a couple of gaps that still exist in that unit. One is to add a forensic accountant so that these financial fraud schemes across all the spectrums that are impacting Minnesotans both in their personal life and then in our government programs are increasingly complicated. And a forensic accountant that's dedicated to examining records and the information we're examining would be a great assistance to that team. Neither of our agencies had that role before, so this would be a new addition to us that we would add in. The second piece is adding 2 attorneys generals to do this work in
prosecution assistance, particularly in greater Minnesota, as they're very difficult cases. Often they're racketeering type of cases that are time intensive and resource intensive. They would be available to assist county attorneys across Minnesota. It wouldn't change any authority. It would simply be a resource to do that. They would also provide legal guidance to our team. We do this similarly with other county attorneys in the Attorney General's office with our Human Trafficking Investigators Task Force to help provide us input along the way as we're working on complicated cases. And the last piece is they would provide assistance to us when a case is either declined, prosecuted, or doesn't move forward, so that they would assist us in providing feedback, if particularly on the government fraud side of things, to state agencies to look for ways to improve their processes, provide prevention activities, etc., in that process. The second item recommended in the governor's budget recommendations is a new missing persons system to track and maintain missing persons in the state of Minnesota. With fairly regularity, about 8,000 to 9,000 people are reported missing in the state of Minnesota. The vast majority of them are located safely in the state, but right now that information is entered into a system and it goes to the FBI. The FBI's database does not allow us to really utilize that data in a significant way to uncover trends, identify patterns, and look for various areas to improve our missing persons cases in the state of Minnesota. If I were to ask the FBI today how many people are missing in Minnesota, they would send me a PDF spreadsheet of the individuals, and they regularly provide it to us, and that is what we would have, and so we can't ingest that. The reason we've been examining this for a number of years, and this is also very much supported as we've started to work with MMIR and MMBGW as they look to better understand missing persons in their offices across Minnesota and our partners, is that we aren't able to learn from them. I'll give an example. If we have a foster child, for example, that ran away in a particular community, say in Belle Plaine, and then they are recovered. They then are reported, they go to a different foster home in Burnsville, and they are then recovered. We know in those situations when you see multiple runaway attempts, there is an increased risk for exploitation of that child, for human trafficking of that individual. And right now, unless those two agencies know or know where that child might have been before, it's difficult to connect those dots to really uncover those patterns and be able to flag that as an at-risk where we could potentially get them additional resources and hopefully identify if they are being exploited, trafficked, et cetera. This database would mean that the data as it's entered, it will still go to the FBI and CIC, but it would pass through our database, and then we would have much more robust reporting and understanding of who's missing in Minnesota, what the patterns are, and how we can better utilize that to provide assistance. This is a one-time cost of $1.5 million to build that database and without ongoing cost. The second item that we wanted to highlight for you, as committees have wanted to see this information, is we have two bonding proposals in the front of the bonding committee. I think we've talked about this before, but one is a critical space need we have for our laboratory in particular. We're absolutely maxed out of space. If you went to our headquarters location, and I welcome all of you to join us for a tour at any time, but those of you who have been there before, it's a very beautiful building. It's a nice building, but we are maxed out of space. We're actually tearing out walls right now and trying to shrink offices as we can. We have everybody down to 6x6 cubicles. Our team has to be in the office, has always been in the office because of the work that we do every day. And so my concern is, as you've provided great support to us to get our turnaround times down in our laboratory, for instance, and we've done a great job doing it. It's the first time I've been in front of you, and I can tell you we do not have a DNA backlog at the moment. But I will also tell you that our trend lines continue to grow. And at some point in time, to keep acceptable turnaround times, we'll have to come back to you and say we need additional staff to keep up with that. If we don't get this project in the pipeline right now, we are not going to have space for our scientists. He also provided funding for a violent crime reduction unit in the last biennium. That team we put into a old fire station, a 20-year-old fire station, remodeled it. In law enforcement, we can make do in a lot of different spaces. For our scientists, we cannot. And so this is a bonding proposal. It's a $68 million project to create a regional office and a laboratory in Mankato. It's in the final design phases right now. We own the land. It's next door to the Justice Center, which is where Blue Earth County Courthouse is, and our partners there, including State Patrol as well. The second piece is to meet our increased space needs is design and land acquisition costs for Bemidji, Minnesota, which is where we currently have a regional office. It would purchase a parcel of land owned owned by the city, and then we had basically doubled the size of our facility there to mirror the size of the Mankato facility, giving us a good regional approach. It's more efficient, frankly, for our work to begin with, and we're a better resource being co-located or close to our partners across the state of Minnesota, and that's 4.203, and we will be back in a future year to seek the construction cost for that facility. This is a rendering. It's a fairly accurate rendering of the Mankato facility because, as I noted, it's almost complete in the design process from there. And with that, we'd all be happy to answer any questions. I don't know if you heard us before that they were referring to this as the detention chair. I'm confident State Fire Marshal's never been in detention. I, unfortunately, have sat in such a chair in the past. So.
You're not in detention, Fire Marshal. All right, so we'll move on to member questions, and if you ask your question, if you could indicate who your question is directed at, that'll make things a little bit smoother. Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you all. I'm going to go with the detention chair first, Superintendent Evans, and just to say, you know, in other committees, in the Fraud Prevention Committee, we've spent a little bit more time talking about this consolidation, and as you know from our conversation early on, I was a little anxious about consolidating commerce fraud with the BCA, but it's actually, and from the additional information and the resources you're asking for, I think it's actually going to be a really good thing. I'm interested if you could talk a little bit about, I know in some of the other committees we talked about just the growth of fraud, both the fraud on our public programs and public funds, and also how it's growing across the economy, that $12.5 billion number is scary, and how, one, if the resources that you're asking for, the forensic accountant and the attorneys general, is that enough? And what are the other things we should be thinking about as we think about the theft of government funds and programs, and also the fraud we're seeing being perpetrated on our veterans and our seniors and pretty much everyone else in the economy?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Mueller and Representative Greenman, thank you for the question. A couple things. Fraud is an increasing problem for all of us, both in our personal lives and in our programs, and has been. The number that you referenced was to the Federal Trade Commission last year. Voluntary reporting by Americans alone was $12.5 billion in individual losses. Some estimates are that the $1 trillion a year are related to fraudulent activities across the United States. This unit combined together really provides us a robust area, and we're able to gain efficiencies by combining the two areas. I'll give a couple of examples. Both of us independently developed an emerging trend that many of you are probably familiar with, is cryptocurrency scams that are seeing. And so we were able to figure out exactly who's doing that, combine those resources, and learn from each other. We also had redundancies such as digital multimedia evidence. We have a whole section at the BCA that this committee has funded of 22 digital evidence examiners. They had to have investigators doing their digital evidence, which is what we did for many years too, until we grew to the point where we could operate an accredited laboratory doing that. So we instantly gained back hours to be spent on investigation through that process. They come to us with a lot of talents they have. We came together with them with talents that we have together, and we're able to then work together on these crimes. The other thing, a little bit related probably to your question, is that in the process, we each had our own singular focuses that we did and lanes that we were in, but yet frauds are across the spectrum. And so this allows us to better understand, are each of the individual units looking at an individual fraud that's not in a government program, but we see the individual also in a government program by really having that focus together moving in one direction. And so we can identify the best case. And if it's in a private fraud, we can arrest that individual for that criminal activity and then prohibit them, disqualify them from receiving public funds in that manner as well. And so it really puts us in a position to be effective. And part of it is it's immediate. We don't have to stand up this unit. They're operating now. They're taking in suspected fraud from state government programs right now through a reporting mechanism that is in place. And it's something that, with everything, we come in front of you when you ask the question, is it enough? We think that we have a lot of capacity by doing this now. And like everything we do, we'll be back in front of you if we don't have the proper resources and make the case to you at a future time if we need additional resources for those activities.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and I really appreciate that, and I think that the breaking down silos and the efficiencies piece, as we think about the innovation, I would say, that we're seeing in different business models of fraud and whether it's targeting our public programs or targeting our small businesses, consumers, whatever else. The other question I had a couple of days ago, we had the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit in front of us, and the good work they're doing and how they're punching above their weight. And it feels like, I think I heard a statistic that like Visa is spending $12 billion on their fraud program. We are obviously not that percentage wise, but are there efficiencies with the Medicaid Fraud Control Unit? How do you all work together as it relates to this budget? Are there additional things we should be thinking about?
Superintendent Evans.
Chair Mueller, Representative Greenman, that's a good question. Traditionally, Medicaid Fraud Control Unit, that's housed in the Attorney General's office, you know, often worked collaboratively and hand-in-hand with the Department of Human Services. And we have a strong relationship at the BCA, generally speaking, with the Attorney General's offices. They're our counsel, and they prosecute a lot of cases we're involved with. We've recently, with the combination of this unit, had a meeting with that team and a broader team within the Attorney General's office looking for additional ways to collaborate. I will note for you that that is not a licensed peace officers in that unit. So historically, whenever they need to execute a warrant or do something that traditional law enforcement does, that we, as both the BCA and the Commerce Fraud Bureau, have assisted them for many years in that. So we've had a collaborative relationship from that. But we're looking, how do we even strengthen that more going forward? And certainly, I know they have you know, recommendations in front of all of you as to ways they are working on, and we'll continue to figure that out. I will tell you that our unit has at least one Medicaid unit, one Medicaid case that we're currently working. It's active. I can't talk about it, but it's done in collaboration with the Attorney General's office. So we're figuring out how to do that moving forward.
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I really appreciate the work you're doing. I think when we're looking at a lot of the across our things that are targeting particular government programs, the silos are oftentimes part of the problem. And when one hand, the left hand and the right hand, aren't talking to each other. And so this effort to really think about efficiencies, but also think about how we're communicating and collaborating, I think will be really good for the state of Minnesota. And I really appreciate the work you're doing.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Chair Mueller. First of all, thank you all for your support and efforts to keep our protecting our community, serving, and keeping all our communities safe. I asked this question earlier, it's probably for you, Commissioner Jacobson. In the next year to 5 years, what do you see for retirements in law enforcement?
Commissioner.
Yeah, thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Witte. Again, I don't have the data at my fingertips, but my concern is that we do have several law enforcement officers across the state of Minnesota that are approaching that retirement age, generally at age 55. I think it's incumbent on all of us. As I came into this position, one of the things that I shared with the governor is that my hope was to uplift public safety. And as part of that was to make sure to get around the state of Minnesota, talk to those who are thinking about becoming law enforcement officers, talk about the honor and traditions of that work, and hopefully to get more people that are interested in that work. We are continuing, of course, across the state of Minnesota. Police chiefs and sheriffs will tell you that there are still challenges in finding enough applicants to become police officers and deputy sheriffs, et cetera, around the state of Minnesota. So it certainly is a concern. I think we are, from our perspective and the governor's budget, you know, putting forward funding for the IC Poet process program, I think is helpful, but I think it's incumbent on all of us to try to make sure that we're spreading the word that this is a great profession and to try to get more people involved.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, and that's one of the things I try to highlight up here is the recruitment and retention and trying to change the wording around our first responders and police officers that are serving our community so we can grow that. Do you, in looking for ways to help you guys out, do you think that IC Poet, the 75 that was funded, that should be more? The numbers I'm hearing are close to 1,000. And 75, I think there's other ways that we can do it. It's been widely successful. And maybe we need to refocus a little bit on that. because I think it will help in the recruitment. You guys have kind of hit on something that I think has been positive and looking for other ways. And if we keep changing the, showing them the support, the 365 days a week with our tone and stuff like that, I think that will increase, you know, the noble profession that is and have people go into it. So any ways we can help out, please let me know.
And I'll just say I appreciate the questions on the IC Poet too. There is a separate bill. I'm not sure if we're going to have time to hear that as a standalone, and I know it's important. So if members have questions about that or comments about that, I think now is a good time to be discussing those as well. So appreciate that. Representative Duran.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And this is for Commissioner Jacobson. We understand in Minnesota that training is very important within our law enforcement officers, and it appears that the law enforcement training is getting cut more and more. Did you have any inputs on that with the governor, or can you explain to us the reason why it appears that the training monies for the law enforcement is getting cut here?
Yeah, and I'll just note that's not in this budget, but go ahead, Commissioner.
Thank you, Chair Mueller, Representative Duran. This is a very difficult budget year, as everybody understands, and funding for programs has become certainly challenging, and trying to maintain funding in various areas has certainly been challenging as well. And I think through the governor's budget, we've tried to make sure that we're supporting law enforcement. I know the difficulty in the reduction in the training funds. I've certainly heard the comments from law enforcement around the state of Minnesota about some concerns with that. I've also heard concerns about making sure that we have some funding available for recruitment of police officers, you know, hence the IC Poet process. So I know that it's a concern to all of us. There's a limited amount of money. Hopefully that local law enforcement agencies will be able to continue to do the training based on the funding that they're getting now, and then continue to have those discussions in the future on how it should be, how that should be funded.
Representative Duran.
I'm good, thank you.
We're going to do things a little out of order here. Chair Novotny.
I got a quick question for Fire Marshal Cryer, if you could come out of the penalty box there. You mentioned the charter school funding changes. Will that make it consistent with the non-charter public schools? I don't know how to clarify that better. You said they're both public schools, but the non-charter public schools, what is the fees for them? And then we'll do it in one. With that in mind, you mentioned that you've got the Tower School here compared to the Altos Leadership Academy in Brooklyn Park. What would that fee go to from the 100 you're paying now to what it would go for by square foot?
Fire Marshal Cryer.
All right, thank you, Chair Mueller and Co-Chair Novotny. So the fee would match the tradition for the public charter schools. It would match the same fee for traditional public schools. It's, I believe, 12 cents per square foot. And then included in that fee is the initial inspection and two re-inspections. And then there's a re-inspection fee of, I believe, 5 cents per square foot if you have to go back a fourth time. So this would be, they would be at the same fee structure, the same fee cost level. And then as far as looking where do the, what the fees go to, and then for the two examples presented, that's covering the cost to perform the inspection, which, you know, in our case for the state fire marshal, it would be our travel costs, as we don't have inspectors in every city or in every county. We have some travel costs associated. It might even be hotel stay, depending on their path of travel. And then the time to do the physical inspection, write the report, and then any correspondence and follow-up afterwards. So looking at these two examples, in my personal experience, doing Athlos Academy, it took a full day, or it could be a half day if I had myself and another inspector. So roughly a day's worth of wages combined with any travel costs. At that time, the travel costs were minimal because we were in the city. And so we exceeded the $100 fee that our cost exceeded the $100 fee that was recovered.
Chair Novotny.
So to follow up on that, is it just, you say 5 cents a square foot?
That's for the re-inspection fee. It's 12 cents a square foot for the initial inspection.
Yep. Fire Marshal Cryer. Oh, sorry, yeah. Chair Novotny. Everybody's handing me a note at the same time here. So, Chair Novotny.
So, you'd be looking at $12,000 for this fire academy, and then if you have to do a follow-up visit, then it's more than if it's a thousand. If it's 100,000 square feet, so 12 cents a square foot, you'd be $12,000, and then if you require for even a second visit, you'd be up to $17,000 a year.
Fire Marshal.
Yeah, thank you, co-chairs. No, now that I, as I'm saying 12 cents, I'm thinking of it in my mind and got the decimal in the wrong spot. So it's 0.00, and that's, it would be great if it just said 12 cents, but of course it's in dollars. It's 0.0012 per square foot. So 1.2 cents per square foot for the initial, half a cent per square foot for the reinspection. So the fee for the 100,000 would be a tenth of, as you put it, so it'd be approximately $1,200. A reinspection would be $500. So I'm sorry for misquoting as I'm doing the math in my head on that.
Thank you.
Chair Novotny.
Thank you.
All right, Representative Rapinski.
Thank you, Chair. I just have a question for the Fire Marshal. So the Firefighter Training Board believes the $5.5 million it receives each year is inadequate to meet its needs. The table reimbursement requests a deficit training reimbursement. What's the DPS, what's the Fire Marshal doing to address this with this shortcoming?
Fire Marshal.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, and thank you, Representative. So the Board of Firefighter Training is a separate group from DPS. However, we have staff support that works with them and administers much of those programs so that there is oversight, things are following, you know, procurement policies and all the applicable things that you want when spending state funds. So we have a great working relationship with the Board of Firefighter Training. The board has sought supplemental funds in times where there are additional asks, training needs for the fire service, and DPS is supportive of making sure that our firefighters are properly trained to be able to do their jobs.
Representative Rapinski.
Okay, thank you, Chair.
Representative Steer.
We pass it off to Rapinski.
Right. Vice Chair Feist.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is for Director Babine. Sorry, musical chair.
Go ahead.
This is such an interesting budget year because so much, like there's a lot in the Office of Justice Programs that's migrating budget spaces. And like I know, I don't even know outside of the juvenile justice space what else might be migrating from OJP to Children, Youth, and Families. But I was just curious, this is kind of an abstract question, but like how do you see kind of the identity and direction of OJP evolving now that some of the important work that you do is migrating to another agency? And how do you see that impacting kind of the size and scale of your operations?
Director Babine.
Thank you, Madam Chair and Vice Chair Feist. That's a great question. So just to clarify the programs that are moving to the Department of Children, Youth, and Families from Department of Public Safety and OJP, that transfer is on June 18th this year, so we have a couple months left. But the programs moving are the Office of Restorative Practices, the Youth Justice Office, and the Youth Intervention Program, grant program, that will be going underneath the Youth Justice Office, but they're not there now, so we like to call them out separately. So we are really looking forward to the opportunity for those programs to be embedded in the Department of Children, Youth, and Families and really benefit from that collaboration and that the work that they'll be able to do there. We're also not letting them go completely. We will maintain strong relationships with them and the work that they're doing because it's very related to the work of our across the agency, across the division, but particularly with the things that we fund through the grant programs. So we understand that there are things that the Office of Restorative Practices grants might fund and focus on, things that the Youth Intervention Program might fund and focus on, and things that, say, the Community Crime Intervention Program or other crime victim services grants that will be remaining at DPS and Office of Justice Programs. We might have some focus in each of those areas, but there's still collaboration that needs to happen to make sure that those programs are not duplicative of each other, and we can make sure that the grant dollars are going to the right places, and we can maximize those dollars. So when we think about those programs moving, the collaboration will still be there even though they're in another agency. When you think about what that means for Office of Justice Programs, into the future, we will very much miss the focus with the Youth Justice Office and the Office of Restorative Practices, but the main tenets and things that we're focused on in the Office of Justice Programs will remain. We are looking, our grant programs work to assist crime victims. Our grant programs work to reduce crime, intervention, prevention, support law enforcement, support other parts of the criminal justice system, and those pieces will remain strong and keep moving and will evolve with the, like I said, that collaboration across and being able to focus in the priorities of each grant program.
Anything else, Vice Chair Feist?
Thank you so much. That was really helpful, and I'm really looking forward to hearing how that collaboration goes, because, specifically, youth present unique public safety challenges, but also unique opportunities for how we can have an impact. We've had a lot of conversations already about data and systems interconnecting, so do continue to report back to us on how we can support that collaboration. Thank you.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm not going to make you guys play musical chairs again, but I want to first thank Superintendent Evans. What you guys do, it's amazing. And getting that overview, I really, really appreciate it and would love to talk with you offline about how we can support you guys, especially with the financial crime side of things, making sure that you guys are equipped to tackle that that increased need that you'll obviously see. My question goes to Fire Marshal Career. So when it comes to these charter schools, I know some of them are owned by somebody else and they're actually subleasing that space. So I believe it was 1954 when the federal government imposed fire marshal standards on schools after 96 children died in a fire, and we haven't seen a death since. So obviously what you guys are doing is working. But if we are going through those charter schools and seeing an increase in it for different changes to comply with those standards, would that payment come from the charter school itself or from whoever owns that building? Is that something that you know off the top of your head? And I know it's kind of in the weeds, but just wanted to check and see.
Fire Marshal.
All right. Thank you, Chair Moeller, and thank you, Representative. So it would depend on the lease agreement on who's responsible. When we do inspections at properties that are leased, we have to get approval from both the owner and from the leasing entity. So in this case, the charter school, because we're there, any action we write is really going to go to the building owner, and then it becomes that private matter of what's written into the lease agreement on who's responsible for which correction.
Representative Ingen.
Understood in full. Thank you.
And I have a question for, I think it is Director Bavine. It's about the Icy Poet and on the slides. I was just curious, it says the funding is for approximately 75 peace officers, $2 million in each year. Is that 75 per year or 75 per the biennium? Director Bavine.
Chair Moeller, I believe that is for the biennium, so 75 total with the $2 million each year.
All right, thanks for that clarification for me. And then I just want to ask about federal cuts. I'm going to do this in a way that is really relevant to the budget. I'm not trying to inflame anyone. I just want to make sure that the things that you're talking about funding here aren't reflective of any potential cuts or freezes at the federal level that at this point. Is that correct, Commissioner?
Yeah, Chair Moeller, yes, that is correct. We are all waiting more information from the federal government and what may happen, but does not include any potential cuts from the federal government.
Thank you. And what are the different areas if there were to be cuts? I know there's interaction in a lot of different areas with Department of Homeland Security, maybe FEMA, Victim Services? I don't need like a detailed answer, but just what are the different areas that we should be kind of on the lookout for when it comes to the Department of Public Safety?
Well, I think there are, Chair Mueller, members of the committee, I think there are federal funds that flow through several of our different divisions in the Department of Public Safety. Certainly the most recent one that has gained some attention is from FEMA, and we're continuing to watch how that may be implemented. You know, there are some discussions about what FEMA may be doing in the future, but as of right now, we have not been informed of any cuts from FEMA in funding. Certainly there are federal funds that flow through the Office of Justice Programs. There are certainly funds that, you know, flow in through Bureau of Criminal Apprehension, and there are likely others that I'm not thinking of right now, but we are, like all of us in state government, continuing to monitor the status of any of that federal funding, and we'll react, based on whatever actions may be taken by the federal government.
Thank you. And it would be helpful to us if you see things that are frozen or not coming through, just to keep us in the loop as well as we're trying to put together the state budget.
Thank Absolutely.
You. All right, moving on.
Thank you.
Yes, thank you, all of you. Appreciate it.
Next presentation we have on the agenda today is from the Department of Corrections. Welcome to the committee, Commissioner Snell. Please state your full name, title, and begin your presentation.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good morning, members. My name is Paul Schnell. I'm the Commissioner at the Department of Corrections. Thank you for having us here today and the opportunity to provide an overview of the budget. We'll get the presentation PowerPoint going here. First, I'd like to provide all the members with some context for this discussion. The DOC has approximately 4,300 staff in our facilities, central office, and in the community. The DOC operates 11 prisons with a combined capacity of 9,500 beds. Though that number reflects facilities when they are fully double bunked. Currently, we have about 8,300 individuals incarcerated in our prisons. The DOC's total facility footprint spans 7.5 million square feet, with some of those buildings being more than a century old. Beyond the prison walls, the DOC provides correctional supervision of around 20,000 people across Minnesota. Of the 95,000 individuals that are subject to community supervision. The DOC operates 13 district supervision offices statewide. The agency also fulfills a number of statutorily required regulatory and administrative functions, including licensing of local correctional facilities and approving county comprehensive plans for community supervision. Also, for your reference, this slide is a very quick visual of the 11 prisons the DOC operates across Minnesota. I would always welcome and encourage you to do a tour if you have not had the opportunity to do that, to speak directly to the incredible staff the DOC has, as well as the individuals that are incarcerated in our facilities. A couple items of note: the facility in Shakopee is the state's only women's prison. Red Wing is the only state juvenile correctional facility operated by the state. St. Cloud serves as the central intake facility for men, and Faribault is the state's largest prison with a population capacity of just over 2,000. And the Togo site is the smallest and one of the two men's challenge incarceration or boot camp programs. The 2023 legislative session came with significant investments and policy changes that have been and or are currently being implemented. Those include things like MRRA and the creation of the Supervised Release Board, Parole Board, and many other major changes that impact the way corrections operates in Minnesota. Going into the previous budget cycle, the DOC had a critical staffing crisis and the lowest state staff retention of any state agency. Do the historic bargain wage increases and investments from this committee toward recruitment and retention, we began 2025 at 99% staffing level. The DEOC has not had a staffing level like this in well over a decade. Historically, the agency has struggled to attract and retain staff, especially among the security ranks. While these items are worth celebrating and will no doubt have a positive impact on the agency for years to come, the DOC does face considerable needs. It is important to note that 97% of the DOC's budget is appropriated by or comes from the state's general fund. And we provide an essential service for the state. Not only do we have a constitutional obligation to provide those who care for those who are incarcerated, but we must also maintain the safety of the public, our staff, and those incarcerated around the clock each day of the year. With that context in mind, I'll provide an overview of the DOC's budget request for the upcoming year and explain how these align with our goals and priorities. First, the DOC is requesting $9.1 million from the state's general fund to address the agency's critical budget shortfall in fiscal year 2025. Also included in the deficiency request is the approval to reallocate $10 million of rider money or unspent program appropriations to help fill this gap. The request is essential to maintaining services and staffing at the current levels for the remainder of the fiscal year. The prevailing factor in the DOC's budget deficiency is the extraordinary staffing level increase. And after years of difficulty and of hiring and retaining staff, we have turned that corner with our new competitive compensation. The department has been able to attract and retain qualified staff, which is crucial, and having a stable workforce is foundational to carrying out the DOC's core functions. Moreover, the agency's historic practice of having and using vacancy savings to cover other budget needs is no longer viable or available, further contributing to the shortfall. This request is urgent to ensure that the DOC is able to operate the remainder of the fiscal year. And by way of background, it has been commonplace in my time and even before for the DOC to make significant requests for supplemental funding after settlement of contracts, which last year there was a small supplemental, but not what was necessary to cover the costs. Next, the DOC is requesting, and the governor's recs, an operating adjustment of $43.3 million for FY26 and $66.9 million for FY27 and each year ongoing. The reasoning for this request is similar to what I had just discussed. Our staffing improvements have been vital for ensuring and providing essential services, but that has placed significant pressure on the department's budget. By way of note, it is not uncommon in an agency as large as ours to budget at with a vacancy gap, which can create problems and does create problems when we finally get the full complement. As we continue to maintain a larger, properly compensated workforce, this increase is necessary to support full staffing and associated costs, such as step increases in benefit costs and the necessity to meet our operational needs going forward. The next proposal is the sunsetting of state funding for sentencing to service, or STS, program at the close of the current fiscal year. This program provides an option for nonviolent and individuals incarcerated in county jails to be sentenced to a period of supervised work in the community, often while they are in jail. However, county participation and crew size in the program have steadily decreased over the years, notably since 2019. The number of individuals completing STS in 2019 was about 5,600. Now that number is cut in half to approximately 2,800 individuals. The state covers 25% of the costs associated with STS and the county covers the remainder of the costs. While this is a difficult decision, it is not the best use of agency staff or resources to continue the program as the cost per client becomes very high. Sunsetting STS, the state will realize an annual savings of approximately $1.8 million. It is notable that counties can still choose to fully fund the STS program, and we know of one county that currently does, but the staff and equipment would no longer be covered by the state. Next, I want to briefly, another item you'll see in the budget request is the bed costs associated with the governor's proposal to increase criminal penalties for theft of public funds. The numbers and costs associated with this are listed on the slide for your reference, but it's approximately $12,000 in 26 and $44,000 in 27, with the tails listed. That concludes the budget request with a fiscal impact to the state. The remaining proposals are budget neutral. First, I want to just cover those to give you some background. We want to extend the mental health unit pilot program. This was originally passed in 2023, and the program allows counties to transfer individuals with serious and persistent mental health issues who are incarcerated in local jails to the mental health unit at MCF Oak Park Heights for both housing and access to specialized treatment. Smaller jails can oftentimes lack the resources or access community expertise to meet the needs of individuals incarcerated with these serious mental health conditions. By transferring these individuals to the MHU at Oak Park Heights, our staff and behavioral health personnel can ensure that they receive the treatment and necessary care in a secure environment. The proposal is to extend this program until August 1st of 2027. Additionally, the language includes the change that a voluntary consent to transfer requirement from the original language to making it a referral basis by a licensed mental health professional to allow more people to qualify to access these beds. Next, the Interstate Compact Unit, which is responsible for managing all transfers of supervision under the Interstate Compact for Adult Offender Supervision. During changes to the community supervision statute in 2023, the costs for the unit were not included in the funding formula and structure. Currently, Interstate Compact Unit is solely funded by prorating that cost across only the counties the DOC serves. Though it provides, though the Interstate Compact Unit provides services to all 87 Minnesota counties. This proposal amends the statute to spread those costs for compact services across every county on a prorated basis on their share of the most recent probation population. This change will ensure that the costs associated with interstate supervision transfers are equally equitably dispersed. The next proposal addresses how supervision funds for tribal nations are distributed and managed. Currently, the legislature allocates $250,000 for the DOC to distribute to each tribal nation for the purposes of providing community supervision or culturally appropriate reentry services in their communities. However, the statute does not specify how the funds should be paid out. This means that each tribal nation must enter into a joint powers agreement with the DOC, which is costly and time-consuming a legal process. The DOC proposes distributing these funds in the same manner that we do county supervision funding, streamlining the process and removing the requirement for a GPA. The language also clarifies what funds can be used for and requires an abbreviated comprehensive plan be submitted to the DOC for how these funds will be used. The next slide covers other budget neutral proposals in the bill, which I will again briefly cover. First, we request legislative approval to transfer certain appropriated funds internally to align with the recent fiscal restructuring at the agency. Next, much of Rule 2940, which governs the work of the DOC's hearings and release unit, is either obsolete, duplicative, or already in statute, and the rulemaking process is costly and time-consuming. As a result, we seek repeal of the rule and codification of the few provisions that remain. Next, we would like to expand the definition used for correctional employees included in fictitious emergency felony policy passed last session. The current definition only covers those physically working in a prison or correctional facilities and not supervision agents or other staff who are exposed to similar risk of retribution. Lastly, we are proposing technical corrections that would provide a more streamlined method for delivery of community supervision funding to non-CCA counties. And finally, chairs and members, by supporting the DOC's budget priorities, we ensure accountability for those offending against our state and community, the security and rehabilitation of those committed to the custody of the DOC or our supervision, while upholding the constitutional obligations and supporting the safety and improved outcomes for the good of Minnesota. With that, Mr. Chair and members, I would stand for any questions the members may have. And I do have phone a friend here from our fiscal team to help me if there are specific questions.
Start off with Representative Schwartz.
Yes, thank you, Commissioner Schmel, for that. I do have a question. Why should we increase the Department of Corrections budget when an active ongoing internal investigation is being conducted in Lana Lakes men's facility that is seeking to reprimand correction officers who are questioning the DOC purchases of women's mascara, high heels, lipstick, and underwear for males convicted of criminal sexual conduct?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, I'm a bit confused by the question, but I think there is an internal investigation because of Minnesota state law requires that investigation of the disclosure of information that is private. That's what we're doing, and that will continue and is necessary by virtue of the laws of this state.
Representative Schwartz. Representative Schwartz, do you have another question?
Yeah, sorry, just a second. Okay. I'm sorry. Just reading my notes here.
Representative Witte.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, Commissioner. One of the slides early on talks about 8,300 inmates, but 20,000 out on probation. And I think we're fifth in probation, but on the lower end. For incarcerations. And I've had people come in and talk, is there any thoughts of shifting some of the money to help with the probation part, especially out in the counties and other places as they are following up? It seems like a few of these are getting lost and it's an overwhelming work load. And I was just wondering if there's any thoughts from your position about shifting.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witte, ultimately, if you look at some of the proposals that were passed in 2023, MRA being one of them, there is an opportunity and for that flow of those dollars to go to community supervision to address those needs. By way, the DOC provides supervision to about 20,000, but just shy of 100,000 people in Minnesota are under some form of correctional supervision. So it is a large number. The legislature did provide a significant investment in community supervision in 2023. I think, as I recall, nearly $50 million. That has made a significant difference. But I believe that the policy work that was done in 2023 should address some of the issues around that transfer of resources based on needs as people move out of the prison system and onto supervision.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you. Where are we at with MRRA? Is it implemented right now?
So Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witte, we have finalized the policy that's been published. We you know, we have been very thoughtful and deliberate about this policy. We have right now a team, and we've identified a number of cases at the Shakopee facility and at the Moose Lake facility that we will work through the workflow of how we process these cases going forward, because we want to make sure that that workflow and process is understood by everyone, and it's brand new for how this occurs. So we will, beginning next week, we will notify the first group of about 20 incarcerated individuals who will walk through that process in a very deliberate way, so that we can learn that process and work with case managers and others across the DOC and our community supervision partners to see what that looks like and what that workflow will be.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you. I trust that you have an idea on it. And the reason I'm asking for the shifts is I think something that was implemented in 2023, we're not there yet. We got a lot of cases. I'm hearing people come in and talk about cases that are getting lost, and it's going to cause us problems. And so that's why I was looking for the short-term fix, if we can do something until this is fully implemented, because I think it is starting to, from what I'm hearing, is more and more frequently. So I trust that you got a good handle on it, and that you will be able to, maybe in the short term, put some fixes until we're fully operant.
Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. One of the questions that I have for you, Commissioner Schnell, is how have the free unlimited phone calls, how has that changed your guys' budget outlook? And maybe we can also refer to your guys' fiscal staff as to how that's put some maybe new restraints on your guys' budgeting.
Commissioner Schnell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Engen, there is an appropriation for that. We have seen a significant amount of increase in access to phone calls. We run approximately 7 million minutes of phone calls per month as we do this, and the appropriation covers the cost for that.
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that. That's a staggering number, 7 million a month.
Yes.
That's incredible. And so you guys are probably monitoring those calls and those minutes as well to see if there are any potential ties to, for example, the incoming narcotics that are being introduced into the facilities. Have you seen an increase that coincides with the phone calls and then potentially some of the issues that are occurring on the inside of the facilities?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Engen, you know, we certainly and historically always have. Whenever there's a phone call from a correctional facility, it talks about the fact that those calls are recorded, monitored, accessed. And so we have always used that to ensure both the safety of the facility and staff. I wouldn't say that we have necessarily seen an increase. What we have seen is certainly a profound impact on I think some of the families of incarcerated people who, as you know, 70% of the people who are incarcerated have children. And in some cases in the past, they were paying several hundred dollars per month to have contact between an incarcerated parent and the child. And today, those things can happen at no cost. And really what that means is that those families are not taking those dollars that could really benefit the well-being of the kids and the community and using them to maintain that contact with the incarcerated parent. So I think that does happen, but I can't say that the phone calls have resulted in increased criminal activity.
Representative Bingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. No, and of course we want them to have that contact with the family, and we're not saying otherwise, but we are saying we need to be monitoring these, and we need to be recording them in real time. Having somebody listen in and say, is this a phone call that is to a family member that's, you know, aiding that family as they're separated, or is this something else? Have you guys been actively recording and monitoring both?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Engen, we actively record every call. We don't and listen to every single call every day. We never have historically. We are looking at technology changes that we are seeing coming, and that's things like AI, which ultimately will be able to, in real time, monitor and watch for certain signals or things that may create problems. And as we do that, that can be really helpful as we go forward. But that is not something that is viable or really happening in places across the country right now. We're starting to see some of the people who provide the phone systems to be able to offer those services, but just beginning.
Representative Megan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you for that answer. I appreciate that. What about the iPad use? Are there restrictions as to what they can access? Are they being monitored or recorded? Obviously, you don't want somebody convicted of CSC to have complete internet access at all times whenever they so please. Can you tell me a little bit about what the internal structure is around that?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Engen, there are a number of different programs or models for the use of that technology. One is those incarcerated folks that are involved in higher ed programs or education programs generally. Even an adult basic ed in many cases have access to a tablet that is specific to educational content. Then we have a contract for that are implementing more broadly tablets that would get provided to people. Those tablets would have it's controlled content. It's a controlled network, and that they can do effectively what we might be able to do in a different, more controlled kind of environment, things like purchase, music, streaming. They could purchase, access to certain news things, but it's all contained within that network and does not go out to the broader network.
Representative Megan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Last question here. So what content can't they access, and have you guys seen any issues as to access that they have gotten via those iPads?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Engen, we do monitor, we do track. We did have a breach of the tablet security in the education program at Faribault. That did result in a significant internal investigation that resulted in two people being charged with access to inappropriate or unlawful content on the outside. We have worked with that vendor. There was a contract vendor that provided those tablets and provides those tablets to correctional facilities and DOCs across the nation. And they were surprised by that somebody was able to crack through that firewall and access the outside. We have worked with both Minit and that vendor to secure that. We have disciplined any of the incarcerated people who are found to have access to altered tablets. And as I mentioned, two people are being criminally prosecuted.
Thank you, Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. It's nice to see you, Commissioner Chanel. My comment and/or question has to deal around a popular program called Sentence to Serve, mm-hmm. It is a very popular tool to use. Because people that don't have the means to pay back their fines, as you stated in the brief here, it's a tool for them to use to pay back their debt to society. And this program is popular, I would say, across the state. I'm just going to talk about my county in particular because we do use them frequently. And they do tend to learn some skills that hopefully will transfer into employment to keep them out of the correctional system. So some of the things that they do in my county would be painting of walls. They take care of the parks, whether it's picking up litter, mowing. They help with the county fairs. If there is flooding, there's debris to pick up, they help with that. And it's just an important service for the residents of the county, because then the people in the county, they see people paying their debt back to society. And I think people really like that, that their tax dollars are actually going to a program that they can see a benefit to that. And you talked about that there's a decrease of the number of people that are going through the system. And I just, the question that I have, would you say that one of the reasons why the number of people using this program is decreasing is because the level of crimes that people are committing no longer fit the parameters of what's in that program?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative Harder, I think the challenge here really is over the course of time that, counties establish their own policies around who, like, for instance, if you have somebody who's incarcerated in their county jail, who can participate in STS, so they may get a day of jail credit, and at the same time, working a day on a crew would give them a second day, so they can effectively get double credit for that day by doing STS. And the counties establish the protocols or the policies around who they are going to authorize to go out. I think one of the challenges is that, if people are at a risk level that they may be able to access work releases, for instance, Huber, as it has been known in the past, then those folks are oftentimes allowed to serve their jail time and go out to do work. And given the low rates of unemployment in our state, I think we're seeing people being able to access jobs that hasn't always been the case historically. And so because of that, I think that's one of the reasons that this has gone down. I also want to be clear that we run institutional work crews, ICWIC, as it's known, and we do that both out of some of the prisons and out of a couple county jails. Those were not included in this. It is the SDS crews, and really, the key distinction here really became, and again, I'm not saying this is the case in every county, but when we begin to look at the number of counties who have withdrawn from the program first, and second, the low numbers of people that are on the crews, you may have one or two people with a full-time crew leader, the cost per client per day becomes really immense. And I think that becomes one of the challenges that both counties have looked at, and certainly we've looked at as the numbers have gone down.
Representative Harder.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you for that response. I will say that because I know some people that are actually, DLC employees that do this work, there is great value in this program. And I hear from the employees that some of it is due to the level of crime that people are committing, that they're not fitting the guidelines anymore. And so maybe what we need to do is to look at what is in the statute and what needs to be addressed to see how we can get more people out here learning new skills, keeping their hands busy, and provide that value to counties. And right, some counties have eliminated the program for a variety of reasons. I mean, they're looking for ways to decrease their budget, whatever the case might be. But from my perspective, and from what I know at the county, there is value to this program, and it is popular. And people do see that, like I just said, they're paying their debt back to society, and they actually see the work that they're doing. And so my recommendation to the governor, if he's listening, is that maybe he needs to take another look at this particular program and how can we change it to make it better for counties and state to use the program, because as you drive around, there's plenty of trash to be picked up. And we could certainly find the people that could do that. So thank you for listening, and hopefully we can continue that conversation.
Response, Commissioner Stone?
Mr. Chair, no, I appreciate that. And I don't want to diminish the value of the program. Trust me, I think it, we simply, as we did analysis, you have to begin to look at, and, we're trying to take a look at programs even that we operate within the DOC, and look at what is the cost per day per client, and what's the ROI, what's the impact on public safety, all these things. But the points you made are well taken. I appreciate that, and I respect the fact that it has been a very popular program over the decades.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for the presentation. I just have a quick question on the tribal supervision funding changes. And you had mentioned that it changes having to do a contract. I just wanted to ask if all of the 11 tribal nations were consulted with this change.
Commissioner Snow.
Mr. Chair, Representative Curran, yes, absolutely. This is in their best interest and ours, and I think it, you know, the requirement, you know, in terms of, like, you know, what's the agreement? There is a funding agreement that effectively happens through that modified comprehensive plan. And these comprehensive plans are done in every county across Minnesota for relates to supervision. So it does comport with exactly what happens by practice across the state.
Representative Kern.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you for that answer, and I really appreciate the collaboration. That's all I have.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner Schnell, I wanted to ask a couple of follow-ups based upon the line of questioning from a couple of my colleagues here, starting with the line of inquiry from Representative Schwartz regarding the investigation in Lionel Lakes due to what's been characterized as a data breach regarding the accommodations for trans-identifying individuals in that male facility. I'm looking here at the document that was provided to Alpha News, and I can see where the data practices concerns are. There are identifiable individuals, OID numbers, preferred names. That's data on individuals, as I understand it. Certainly understand where that would require under statute, as you noted, an investigation to find out how that information got leaked to the press. My question is, the other two tabs there, which is kind of like the approved requests and the approved property, including women's undergarments, eyeliner, mascara, high heels and such, are those, if that information, if the personal information data on individuals had been redacted and we just had the list of accommodations that have been made, would that, in your view, be a violation of data practices under current state law and necessitate the investigation that's ongoing in Lionel Lakes?
Commissioners.
Mr. Chair, Representative, I think, you know, if somebody were to ask what are the range of accommodations that get provided across the DOC, that information is available to people. There's a process for it. We have policies that indicate how those requests come in and who provides that information, but that information itself would not be improper to be shared. It's broad general data that is not specific to an individual or necessary, as long as it's not necessarily identifying, that's the issue. As you point out, in this case, there is a private identifying data. And again, I would go back to the fact that when you look at this issue, this is a medical issue that's grounded in gender dysphoria, and that's really why accommodations are provided. And we provide a host of accommodations across the DOC, everything from single bunking units to no top bunks to wheelchairs, canes, you name it. We provide that, and we would be happy to provide a list of the range of accommodations that people have, and it's long and comprehensive.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Schnell. I appreciate the fact that you're affirming the public's right to know both DOC policy and how it's implemented, and certainly some trying to require that data in the appropriate fashion is well advised. My second question was regarding the line of questioning from Representative Ingen regarding the free phones. We've heard anecdotes that a phenomenon has unintentionally resulted in correctional facilities where now folks who, and I don't know how to properly refer to them, but, you know, cliques, gangs, whatever you want to call them, have taken to limiting people's access to phones and requiring some form of extortion of pay me this, pay me that, give me this, give me that, in order to be able to call people. Can you speak to that, confirm it, or talk about what your response has been?
Commissioner Stout.
Mr. Chair, yes, Representative, we do have those issues, and we security groups have, you know, they're for us, they're security threat groups, gang activity, oftentimes organized groups who do this and attempt to exploit the or control phones. What we have had to do is we staff those more heavily. We've changed processes in some facilities; they require a sign up. One of the things that I just approved in the last couple of days was that we will be implementing a gap between calls. So right now, a person, you know, phone call is 15 minutes in length, but a person could end that call and start another. What we are going to do is implement a process whereby there would have to be a gap. And what that will allow is for a better, easier monitoring of calls and not allowing certain groups to control phones for their group versus allowing access more broadly. And this is a phenomenon that happens in every DOC. One of the long-term fixes to this is that in some states have been implemented and would be a possibility here, is that as tablets get implemented, phone dialers can become an option where they can dial from the tablet, and we can limit, you know, what access, who they call, the times the phone's available. All of those things can be controlled universally or individually across the facility. But yes, that has been an issue, and it's something that we manage on an ongoing basis.
Representative Hudson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Commissioner Schnell, for that additional information.
Representative Duran.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner, for coming out here and presenting to us today. Can you tell me how Earn Sick and Save Time and Paid Family Medical Leave is going to affect you guys?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, we know that there is an impact. We have addressed this by way of a plan, but we are still wanting to know exactly what the impacts of that will be. You know, we struggle, we've always struggled, I think, with whether it's, managing time off, making sure people get their time off. Now, for the first time, we're really, with our staffing levels, are able to, get people the time off that they need and those sorts of things. Our issue has been that we've never been at complement. And the fact that we are at complement gives us more ability, more room to be able to manage, whether it's paid family leave or vacation leaves or military leaves. And we have many people who proudly serve in the Minnesota National Guard that work for us as well. And so we have to manage all of these different leave needs. And the fact that we are at complement really allows us or helps us to do that.
Representative Duran.
Do you see an increase in your budget because of it?
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, we are still assessing, what that looks like. I think the issue for us is how do we manage that with inside? Sometimes that can be with, moving staff around and those sorts of things might be ways that we manage those issues, but we do not have a full sense of exactly what the impact will be.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, and thank you, Commissioner Schnell, for this presentation. I had a question about the mental health unit pilot program extension. I know in my county, Carver County, we had an inmate who was in jail for a lot longer than we had the resources to care for this individual. He was severely mentally ill. The staff, didn't have the training to deal with him, and there were no beds in the state to accommodate his needs. And so, I'm curious about how the pilot program is working. I'm curious if there's a waiting list or if the need for this care has been, alleviated by this program. And then my other question is, I've heard it's less about available beds and more about the need for staffing. And I'm guessing I'd love to have you address that. Thank you.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, Representative, it's a great question. We this has been an option that has been available for some time. We, to be totally frank, we have not been able to take somebody on, and in part because of the voluntary nature of it. We did accept one individual for a greater Minnesota county where that individual, you know, had a background as an MMA fighter and had a very, very serious mental health issue and had been highly assaultive, and you know, the jail was really challenged in terms of dealing with him, and we were able to work out through court order an arrangement to bring him into the DOC, because eventually, you know, he was ultimately committed to our custody anyway. But it then requires a lot of time. We have staff that are in the mental health unit around the clock, nurses that are there, and correctional security staff. Psychiatry is in there, and psychology is in there on a day-to-day basis. That's not something that jails generally have access to. What we really would like to do is make sure that this option's available. We know that there are people with serious and persistent mental illnesses that are awaiting, you know, Rule 20 evaluations. This is not intended or really going to fix a lot of that. It's five beds. We want to be able to be good partners. And one of the issues in this is some of the costs associated with this come back to the county. Now, we are, you know, talking about looking at the ways that this gets addressed, because we do think that, you know, this is a criminal justice system problem. And to what extent can we as the DOC, with available bed space, help meet the needs for this particular high-risk population? So we think that the change in the statutory language will open that door more. And I can tell you in conversations I've had with sheriffs, there are a number that would love to be able to access this and use this resource, as the majority of these people are going to be likely ending up in DOC custody anyway. And so our ability to begin that intervention, stabilization, and so forth really matters, and it can improve the safety outcomes at the local correctional facilities or even to mental health providers that may be providing services to that individual. So we really want to, this is, we believe, is a good resource and an opportunity to be good partners with sheriffs and jails across the state.
Senator Bream.
Thank you for that explanation. I appreciate that.
Well, Representative, put your chairs in the upright position, because we have a couple of questions left and we appear to be landing close to on time, so... Chair Moeller.
I'll be brief, Mr. Chair. Thank you. Well, first I wanted to say, Commissioner, thank you. I'm really impressed with the staffing levels. You know, it wasn't too long ago that we were sitting here and all of us were really fretting about how we could recruit and retain more DOC staff, more COs. And so I just really appreciate all the effort that has gone into that, and I'm glad to see those numbers where they are right now. I'll also just say I'm hearing there's a question about sick and leave policies, but I do know that as state employees and as union members, this isn't like we're going from zero to, you know, to having these policies. These employees had pretty, you know, good policies before. You know, I'm also hearing some concerns about data breaches, and we share those concerns too about any data breaches of any private information that's gone out, and we certainly would ask for what the extent you're able to share with us the results of investigation. We would certainly be interested in getting that information as well. You know, there are a lot of questions, I think, about phone calls, and I think there's some bills coming on Wednesday related to that, so hopefully you'll be back as well for that. I'll just note that, you know, as we heard from the Secretary of Public Safety in Oklahoma, for those of you who weren't on the committee yet during the interim in December, we had a really great presentation from Secretary Everett, because Oklahoma has really done a lot with rehabilitation. And this is not something that, you know, Minnesota's being like so lefty on or whatever. These are things that both red states and blue states are doing, because these connections that people can have with their family mean a lot, not only to the people who are incarcerated and are going to be getting out again for the most part,
it also means something to their family members who they're connecting with. And I remember her sharing the story about, with the pad, someone being able to watch their child's graduation and how impactful that was, not only for the incarcerated person, but also for the child who knew their family member was able to watch that. And I think those kinds of supports are important. But I look forward to continued discussion on that issue. And then finally, Vice Chair Witte, you had mentioned it was earlier on in the questioning, so I can't remember all of it, related to supervision and the counties. And I have thought a lot about, too, about how our fiscal notes that we get don't reflect the impacts that counties would have on with the supervision costs. And I'm really interested in exploring that in the interim and thinking about ways we can better address that. I think there's a bill coming. The counties, of course, are coming with a request for more funding. And so we'll certainly consider that. But I do think it's some work we can be doing in the interim to kind of tackle that issue. And I welcome the opportunity to work with you on that if you're interested. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Commissioner Snell, I just have a couple questions for you real quick. In the past, we've talked about the mail scanners. Do we have mail scanners at all facilities for, I believe they're the drug scanners?
Mr. Chair, yes. There are ion scanners at all facilities. With an appropriation on some security technology dollars from last year around, they're the final purchase of a few more to be able to make sure that we have double coverage. We still get a lot of publications, books, all of those things go through ion scanning.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. Next question: the text behind system that you implemented last fall, I believe it was, to cut down on the drugs being introduced into the prisons. What is that costing right now, and when will that be open to bidding for competitive bidding?
Mr. Chair, that the annual cost on that is $500,000. The RFP is in development. That was a one-year contract, and we'll be going out to bid.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. Out of that $500,000, is that the cost of the service or the plan, and does that include the printing? Because it sounds like what I'm being told is we end up printing back here in Minnesota. It's electronically transferred back here after it's scanned and then printed here.
Mr. Chair, no, the text, when all mail going to text behind gets scanned, photocopied, and shipped to each facility for each individual incarcerated person for distribution. So we do not photocopy that mail that goes out to them.
So that $500,000 includes the printing?
Mr. Chair, that's correct.
Thank you. We've talked a lot in the past about the OPA backlog and staffing. Are we currently fully staffed on OPA?
Mr. Chair, we are fully staffed. OPA for others is the Office of Professional Accountability. That is fully staffed, and I believe they are actively working on 24 cases.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. And of those 24 cases, what's the backlog in cases? Do we have employees that are not currently at their assigned workstations because they're awaiting the results of those investigations?
Mr. Chair, we do have a couple of employees that are on leave status. Sometimes that is because of outside investigations that the DOC is not directly involved in. In other words, they may be a subject of a criminal investigation that makes them ineligible to be inside. So we do have instances of that.
So, Commissioner Snell, to be specific, do we have any staff that is currently being investigated or waiting for the results of the OPA investigation that are not at their current workstation?
Mr. Chair, I believe there are one or two that are in that status. And then there is, I believe, one who is out based on an outside investigation.
And Commissioner Snell, last question on OPA. How long is that staff or a couple staff been out of their current workstation?
Mr. Chair, right now we are running approximately on the max side about 6 weeks for the turnaround in those cases or less. And so as we've filled out that unit, they're able to turn those cases much, much quicker. You know, usually it's somewhere between four weeks, and right now we want to have them all completed within six for sure. It just depends on the complexity of the investigation and the number of people that may need to be interviewed.
Thank you, Commissioner Snell. Last question I have, and it's more of a technical question. When we calculate the savings of eliminating the STS program, at least as it worked with the county sentencing when I was still there, they got credit for the work credit. So if they had a good time, and they'd also get a credit for the work credit, so they could double up their time and cut their sentences down. Does it work that same way with the state correctional or the state STS crews?
Mr. Chair, no. The ICWIC crews, they do not get a double credit. That is just a work crew assignment. They work in a variety of communities across the state on a contractual basis and do much of the work that STS crews have done. But generally, that's more around in the areas of the prisons. And then I think there are two or three outstate counties that we operate ICWIC crews out of their county jails as well. But no, they do not get double credit for that.
All right, that's all I have. And sticking with the landing fees, not only do we need to put our trays up, it would really help staff when we clean up if we put everything together and start cleaning up. Obviously we've got a collection of drinks and things like that. If we can help our staff get cleaned up because they want to get out of here too. With that, members, that concludes today's agenda. This meeting is adjourned.